Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Heritage Radio Networks. We dig plants.
Hello, hello.
I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And this is our second summer 2016 extra special show.
Because we knew that you missed us.
Yeah. And we miss you.
We miss you, and we had to come back. And
it's nice to use our brains instead of our
bodies.
Bodies. For our gardening work. Oh, boy.
We'll keep it clean, I promise, David.
Maybe we sound a little dehydrated.
We are. It's very hot. It was very hot and sticky last week in the garden.
So it's July, and we've just celebrated the 4th of July, and today's topic is going to cover the red, white, and green of gardening in the nation's capital. This topic piqued our interest several years ago as Michelle Obama planted an organic veggie garden on the lawn of the White House. When the Obamas took the political front and center place 7 years ago. We tried valiantly to get Michelle on our show to discuss the garden, but, you know, she just wouldn't call us back.
Michelle, you still have time.
Yes.
Okay. At FLOTUS.
Yes.
You have, what, another 4 or 5 months? You can, and you know what? You can come on even after you leave the White House.
And we will still buy you a pizza.
That's right. Just, it's a permanent like invitation out there.
Meanwhile, we've been, you know, racking our brains, trying to get the Obamas to pay attention to us. And lo and behold, this amazing friend and garden writer of ours, Marta McDowell, was embarking on an amazing book, a larger book, rather than just one garden. She, for the last couple of years, has been working on a book, and today she is going to be our guest, and we're going to talk about her book, All the President's Gardens, Madison's Cabbages to Kennedy's Roses, How the White House Grounds Have Grown with America, author Marta McDowell and Timber Press.
So a little bit about Marta. She was on the show once before talking about Beatrix Potter's Gardening Life, which is also an incredible book. Incredible research went into it. Marta lives, gardens, and writes in Chatham, New Jersey. She teaches garden history and horticulture at the New York Botanical Garden, where she studied landscape design. She's a popular lecturer. Marta speaks to gardening groups across the country. And as I said, she's also the author of Beatrix Potter's Gardening Life, which was also by Timber. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Marta, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Hi, Alice. Hi, Carmen.
Hi, Marta.
So before we get into it, I just want to do a shout out to another gardening friend from across the pond, as it were, Enrico Della, such a sweet guy. He's a professional gardener working in Florence, Italy. And he reached out to us and said that he is learning and practicing his English by listening to We Dig Plants.
Yeah.
Which is so sweet. So thanks for reaching out, Enrico. We'd love to hear from our fans. So
Marta, tell us about the inspiration for the book and how this topic came about in your gardening brain.
So, well, I guess I have to confess to start, this wasn't my idea.
Ah.
But you. So I am sitting at my desk one day, and I call my editor, Tom Fisher, who is just a swell guy. And I said, Tom, how about if I write a book about that Concord crowd? Emerson, Thoreau, Louisa May Alcott. You know, they all garden together. Hawthorne, I don't know, there's something in the water.
The Bloomsbury
and
crowd, right?
He said, gee, that sounds great. I'd buy it, but I don't think anyone else would.
Right.
So, anyway, he said, why don't you write a history of American gardening? And I am sure my face fell.
Yeah, that's big. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, it's like we're kind of a big place.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, you know, what my brother-in-law can grow in New Mexico is very different from what we can grow around here.
Right.
Et cetera. It's been kind of a long history, depending on how you count. And I just thought, this is going to take me the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So I did what, you know, it's like a popular teacher thing. You learn from your students, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of my students at the New York Botanical Gardens, Seamus, he was from South Africa, is from South Africa, and he had done a little project, you know, like a short end-of-term project on the White House Gardens. And it was really interesting. It was a lot of stuff I'd never heard of before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote to him and said, can I steal your idea?
Yeah. Good.
So he was very gracious about that and said yes. And that is how I started galloping off on this quest to look at American gardening through this lens of 18 acres that we have dubbed the White House grounds.
So how did you go about doing the research? Because that, you know, did you contact the White House and were they helpful letting you into the archives?
Well, okay. So I had about the same experience that you did.
Yeah.
I did contact the White House and I heard nothing.
Yeah. Crickets.
Right? Crickets, right.
So, you know, I did what, you know, I've always heard people say this. They say, well, you know, I contacted my congressman.
Ah, right.
So I contacted my congressman, who is Rodney Frelinghuysen, and he and his staff kind of kept at it until I did get entree to have a tour and a good, solid interview, not with Michelle Obama, but with Jim Adams, who is the current chief horticulturist at the White House.
Okay.
And then beyond that, luckily, for me, as a researcher, a lot of this is a matter of public record.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in the places like the National Archives, which includes the presidential libraries, and lots of people have studied the Founding Fathers, so that stuff is, you know, is really easy to find. So it was a lot of material, but getting access to the archival part wasn't actually quite that hard.
Right.
And you have incredible, you sourced some incredible imagery and documents, Marta, that really, like, opens up each era for me to see. You know, political cartoons, like so many different levels, you know, seed catalogs,
drawings,
letters, drawings, like really, it's like a very multi-layered book, you know.
The visual parts are a ton of fun, especially because I like to tell stories. And for me, it's that, you know, a picture really can help you tell the story, especially with gardens, right?
Yeah.
So we're all visual, tactile people if we're attracted to gardening of any kind.
Yes.
And so it was a lot of fun. And the great thing about our present day is that there's so much that's accessible. Even eBay, you know, I bought a lot of old paper on eBay where some incredible people, you know, find old newspapers and make them available.
Right.
Piece by piece, it must take them forever, but God bless them all.
Right. Well, it's such a great topic because the White House really is such a symbol of America. And the fact that there isn't a book like this, like a comprehensive, you know, like a grounds kind of overview, is astounding to me, given all the literature that's out there in the world, right?
Yeah, well, you know, there have been other books about sort of the White House in total, sort of as the house and grounds. There have been other books about the gardens, but I tried to focus on how is this sort of the fashion funnel for the country?
Right.
What is it, right, about this very highly cultivated piece of property that shows something about the rest of us and what we've been doing for these hundreds of years?
Yeah, so let's get started in sort of the meat. And I think we all kind of know that as the idea of a capital was being bounced around back during and after the Revolution, you know, Trenton, Philly,
New York was considered.
Right. So tell us why Washington, D.C.?
Well, it was a big compromise. The people in the North really would have preferred it to be in New York City or thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
The Southerners wanted to have the kind of center of political power be closer to them. And so it was hashed out over dinner. You know, it's like, wow, get to go to dinner with Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, they made a big trade, right? So Hamilton got his central bank and centralized the debt.
Uh-huh.
And Madison, Jefferson, and also George Washington, who wasn't there but certainly was behind it, got their federal city on the Potomac.
Right.
And so
a little closer to beautiful Virginia.
That's right. You know, that's right.
Yeah.
Just a close
commute, right? They didn't have to go far.
So I'm sure you've read the Andrea Wolf book, The Founding Gardeners.
Yes.
Yeah. That Carmen and I had Andrea on, and we've referenced that book several times. Yeah. Can you give us a quick kind of gardener perspective on Washington and Jefferson and Madison and Bartram and those kind of early founding gardeners?
So they loved plants, absolutely loved plants. They loved both plants that we would now call native plants, you know, things that grew in their area and on the continent or the colonies at the time and in the early nation. And they also loved exotic plants. And so they were collectors of various things, trees and shrubs and flowers and vegetables. Jefferson in particular just had a passion for vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And Bartram was one of their suppliers. So Bartram and his sons were early botanists in Philadelphia, and they had, you know, what is arguably America's first botanical garden slash nursery, because they were also selling things.
Mm-hmm.
And they did mail order, which surprised me, you know, like it seemed early, but they did mail order both, you know, in the United States, and also Bartram had been sending boxes across the sea.
Right.
Yes. One of Andrea's other books is called Brother Gardeners.
Right.
And it's about, you know, Bartram and his British customers, if you will, going back and forth.
Right. So let's also talk about McMahon, because he was a very early proponent in gardening. Can you tell our listeners who he was and what his contributions were?
Yeah, so Bernard McMahon was an Irish immigrant, and he opened up a shop in Philadelphia and started selling seeds. He also had property in the in the area of the city where he also grew things on, so seeds and plants. And he wrote America's first gardening book, sort of for America. It was still adapted from British sources, but it was called The American Gardener's Calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent a book to Thomas Jefferson, you know, being good at marketing. So mm-hmm. talk about PR, right?
Right.
You know, here's a copy of my book. And so he and Jefferson were correspondents. They sent plants back and forth. He did supply plants to James Madison during his administration at the president's house. So he was really, you know, sort of formative. I think, like, not a whole lot is known about him. People didn't save his papers very much. So he's sort of, you know, fallen from view, but
right.
was a really important fellow.
Well, and wasn't it McMahon that supplied the Lombardy poplars, right, that line Pennsylvania Avenue and the connection to the Capitol?
So Lombardy poplars were a very early street tree in America and, mm-hmm. you know, not used very much anymore because they turned out to have a lot of, you know, pest problems and things, and they're not very long-lived. But they do have a nice form. And McMahon was one of the early nurserymen to grow them on. There was a famous garden and gardener in Philadelphia named William Hamilton, who was rich and collected a lot of plants. And he brought in the Lombardy poplar, and then they started propagating it in various places. So Jefferson loved the tree. He planted a lot of them. And, you know, they didn't really survive. But it was an instance of this early idea of trying to beautify not just your property, but also the urban civic spaces as well.
Mm-hmm. And what were, how would you describe, Marta, the grounds of the White House at that early stage? Was it very open? Was it even open to the public? Could people just come onto the property and stroll the grounds?
Well, when the John Adams and Abigail Adams moved there, it was basically still a construction site.
Okay.
But when Jefferson was there, you know, and kind of started planting the grounds, the back in particular was kind of almost like a public park. So people mm-hmm. did just stroll. There are lots of pictures and paintings that show people just kind of hanging around, strolling, you know, lounging on the grass, mm-hmm. things you don't get to do anymore.
Yeah, it's changed remarkably since then.
And
It has. But up to, like, the Lincoln administration, it was still fairly open up to the Civil War. And then after that, you know, sort of security things kind of came into play.
Right. Right. So let's jump into Andrew Jackson Downing.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of rural art and rural taste, which was one of his kind of manuscripts published in The Horticulturalist. Can you talk a little bit about that and the design of the White House grounds?
Sure. So Andrew Jackson Downing, New York boy, right? He, mm-hmm. he was born in Poughkeepsie, lived in the area all along the Hudson River the whole time of his life, of his short, sadly, life. And by the 1840s, he was really a big name in gardening and, you know, sort of landscape design. And so he had been hired by the federal government, Millard Fillmore and Company, to do a plan for the Capitol and also for the executive grounds. He also was very active in lobbying for major parks in the middle of New York City. So mm-hmm. we also can thank him for Central Park. Although he died prior to the design actually being done.
Right.
But he had this idea that, you know, it should be picturesque, right? And we should have these elements of surprises. So it was really, again, kind of a more romantic garden style. So a little less French, which is kind of the way it was done early on, and then a little bit more back to an English garden style.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it makes sense. You know, we've kind of gotten over the Revolutionary War by the 1840s and are, you know, starting to feel more friendly. The Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, let me say that, you know, yes, they also burned the White House in 1814.
Right. Yeah. Well, okay. So then, I mean, obviously we only have 45 minutes, so we're just going to like hop through some of these design trends, right? So,
absolutely.
So let's talk about the kind of Victorian gilded garden age.
Oh, that's such a great right? age, though. It's so,
yeah.
It's just so many new plants were coming into commerce.
Right. And this was the visual display of greenhouses and glasshouses and bedding plants.
Yeah. And talk about the greenhouses, because that White House had a lot of square feet under glass during that age.
Yeah, that was a big surprise to me. How much greenhouse and sort of display conservatory space there was connected directly to the White House. So instead of the West Wing, right, we all know the West Wing, it's where the Oval Office is, that whole wing was all just a series, one after another, of conservatory and display houses.
Right.
So, you know, you could stroll out after dinner, you know, right from the dining room in to see this display of exotic plants. Again, it was everything from cactuses and palms to orchids and violets and, you know, sort of you name it.
Right.
In fact, the Hayes, Rutherford B. Hayes and Lucy Hayes, were temperance advocates. So they didn't serve alcohol at the White House, which was not popular with everyone, as you might imagine.
Oh, my gosh. How do you lubricate conversations?
At the time, said of one of their parties something like, it was a brilliant affair. The water flowed like champagne.
Wait, didn't she have a nickname?
Let me show you my roses.
Oh, yes. Poor Mrs. Hayes, the first First Lady to be a college graduate, was dubbed Lemonade Lucy.
Oh.
Yes, poor thing. Oh. So, you know, they did many wonderful things, but they are remembered for that. But they actually opened up doors from the state dining room directly into these conservatories. So after dinner, instead of serving, you know, your after-dinner drinks, they would bring people around through the conservatories and then basically usher them out the door, and that was the end of the party.
Don't let the greenhouse door hit you on the way out. Yeah.
Well, if you look at a drawing, right, of the grounds of the house with the greenhouses during that period, there is, like, almost as much square footage for greenhouse space, maybe more. It was a huge amount of space.
It was a huge amount. And that would be an interesting statistic. I don't know if it's ever been done, but I'm not sure. It might have been more glass houses than
brick and mortar.
Greenhouses.
Yeah.
And Carolyn Harrison, Benjamin Harrison's wife, actually wanted to put on way more and have this gigantic, like, palatial setup where they would build essentially another house the same size as the White House and then have a big square of glass houses with a central courtyard. It was going to be very over the top.
I guess Congress didn't approve that budget.
Yeah, I guess not.
So we have to talk about, we gave a couple of teasers during the week, Marta, about the book. And one of the things that cracked me up was the manure scandal with Mrs. Lincoln.
Oh, yes.
You have to talk about that.
At the time, in my house growing up, President Lincoln was a huge favorite. My mother had grown up in Lincoln, Illinois. And so this was a really big deal. And so, of course, I was very interested in President Lincoln. He was, let's say, a little too busy to spend much effort on the gardens.
Right.
But Mrs. Lincoln, Mary Todd Lincoln, did love flowers. She always loved to have a nosegay. You know, she's often shown sort of adorned with flowers, you know, in her various fancy regalia. And her gardener would have supplied all of those, you know, with his staff from the glass houses. So one of the things they were doing with all of these under glass gardens was supplying the house and supplying cut flowers. And but she had a little bit of a, shall we say, like a retail therapy problem. You know, that's what we call it now. She loved to buy things. And, in her defense, the White House at the time had gotten kind of shabby, so she wanted to buy new furnishings and rugs and fabrics and things. And she did love to buy clothing, and she got way into debt. You know, she just ran through her budget. I mean, they didn't have credit cards, so you just ran a line of credit.
Right.
And so the gardener decided he would help her out by padding the budget for his, you know, the greenhouse, the grounds. You know, it's like, well, I'll make it look like I bought extra grass seed and et cetera. So anyway, someone in Congress got wind of this, and they called it the manure fund. he gets fired for this. He gets dismissed. Yeah. And I don't know what Mary Todd Lincoln did to pay off her creditors, but that was the end of that.
She came from some money, Marta, right? So maybe her dad helped her out.
Maybe so. Who knows? Although I think that he was, like, not pro-union.
Oh, and there's still that same kind of shenanigans at the White House.
Yeah.
Right? And in Congress.
It's still
just robbing Peter to pay Paul.
One thing you learn is there's nothing new. You know, like, this kind of, you know, very over-the-top political fight has been going on for the whole time.
So we have to talk about the cherry trees.
Yes,
right? The Washington cherry trees and the Tafts, right? And I didn't realize that Taft, before he was president, was actually an ambassador to the Philippines and was a contemporary of David Fairchild. Is that right?
Yes. So Taft was the governor, right? The Philippines, after the Spanish-American War, were, I guess, almost a colony for a while. And so the Tafts were stationed there, if you will. And so he was the big cheese in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And so they did a lot of urban planning in Manila with American urban planners. And one of the things they did was lay out a big public park called Luneta Park. And Helen Taft loved this park. She loved, you know, the whole, like, sort of gathering. People would go out for strolls, and they would take carriage rides through the park. And so she wanted that sort of thing for Washington. And concurrently with this, there was another woman named Eliza Sidmore who had traveled in Japan. She was a journalist, and she was on the board of the National Geographic Society. And so she loved the cherry trees in Japan, and she had been lobbying. David Fairchild, who's a big botanist, and Fairchild Gardens in Florida is named for him, he loved cherry trees. And so these three kind of coalesced, and, you know, with Mrs. Taft's push, because she was First Lady, they got this big project underway to plant out Potomac Park with cherry trees. And the Japanese ambassador arranged that they be sent a big shipment. It was a total disaster because the first shipment was infested with bugs and it had to be burnt. Then they had to get another shipment.
Ouch.
But it did eventually happen, and it really made a difference in terms of everybody wanted to have cherry trees, right? So now, you know, Brooklyn Botanic Garden has its wonderful cherry trees, and there are cherry trees in Central Park and cherry trees all over the country.
Right.
And it all started there.
We have to take a break, unfortunately. Give us a minute. Marta, stay on the line. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
We'll be right back.
Hello out there, it's Steve Jenkins. I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind, from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
Hi, welcome back to Breathing Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. In Philadelphia, in 2 weeks, there's going to be the Democratic National Convention. In Cleveland, July 18th, the Republican National Convention. But today...
Duke it out.
We're going to be duking it out. Manure is going to be slung. But today we're talking about a different kind of manure and a different kind of gardening. Marta McDowell is with us talking about all the president's gardens, basically a history of the White House gardens.
Mm-hmm.
So, Marta, we've covered a lot of ground in a short amount of time.
But on bump.
But on bump. let's go a little into the 20th century now and talk about... World War II and Victory Gardens.
So Victory Gardens were the next stage. So during World War I, they had something called war gardening.
Right.
And the National War Gardens effort.
Mm-hmm.
And they clearly got a better ad man in between because by World War II, they started calling them Victory Gardens, which sounds much more fun to do.
Right, yeah.
There was actually a Victory Garden at the White House on the South Grounds, but neither of the Roosevelts ever worked in the garden. It was actually one of their advisors. It was his family who worked this little Victory Garden there. But it was all a part of America trying to get behind the effort. There were great food shortages in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and... you know, things were really tight, so people, you know, kind of pitched in
so the idea,
grew vegetables.
The idea of the Victory Garden started with the White House. Is that correct?
I don't think they had the first one, but it was definitely a symbolic effort, you know,
okay.
to have it be part of it. I mean, during World War I, they had sheep on the White House lawn, but no war garden there.
Hmm.
I mean, there really has been a long history of vegetable growing
sure.
on the grounds, you know,
mm-hmm.
from the very early days, why it's called Madison's Cabbages, right? So
right.
from the first plant order, you start to see lots of different vegetable seeds being ordered. And basically up through, you know, almost the whole 19th century, you had vegetables being grown there. But then by the 20th century, that sort of went away completely. I think by FDR's administration, they basically had mint for iced tea.
That's it. So the gardens really became more of like a show piece and a sort of ornamental. And they took away
yes.
the greenhouses, right? They built out the West Wing. Right?
Right. Well, yes. that was Taft, right?
And he got rid of...
It was his administration that oversaw the Oval Office. Right?
Yeah.
So Teddy Roosevelt's administration, the glass houses come off, and
right.
he builds the predecessor to the West Wing. And then Taft, who follows him, puts on what we think of as the Oval Office, although it did get moved one more time.
Uh-huh. But it became more a... entertainment, and it became more of a strolling, like there were strolling gardens, and it wasn't that the activity happened in the house, it was now coming out of the house, right?
Yes, so the grounds were essentially ornamental. They
uh-huh,
weren't
yeah.
used for any kind of food production at
mm-hmm.
that point.
Mm-hmm. And then it was Truman, it was at Truman's legacy that really brought about the idea of the instant garden gratification. So
yes.
in 1952...
Yeah, so I blame Truman, right,
yeah.
for this idea that you can, in a weekend, have a new garden.
Right.
You know, it's much, as we know, it's much harder than that. But Truman, you know, to his credit, I mean, he had to suffer through the White House almost falling down and having the whole thing reconstructed. They dug up the whole front lawn and put in things like a bomb shelter, right? This is now the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And so when it was finished, he was having this visit. I think it was the Queen of the Netherlands was coming. And so basically he had, you know, sod rolled out like carpeting, these gigantic boxwoods brought in, and a cherry tree in bloom,
right,
planted just for that day.
Yeah, it's, and this is like, and then Eisenhower does this putting green.
Really? That's so amazing.
So it becomes this like Leave It to Beaver sort of Scott's fertilizer, like modernity, like you can do this quick, easy, look at what progress we've made, right? Like it's kind of a symbol.
Yes, right. Because we have chemicals.
Right, exactly. And then,
right, so that's it's part of the culture, and it happened at the White House just like it happened in, you know, my little suburb here in New Jersey and Levittown, and any number of
post-war
places that you can mention.
Yeah, post-war progress, you know?
Yeah.
So then let's talk about the Kennedys, right?
Yeah. And they're very much associated with the garden.
And the idea of Bunny Mellon, right? And the Rose Garden. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So, you know, Kennedy was the first president that I have a real memory of.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but Jacqueline Kennedy had this televised tour through the newly redecorated interior of the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still have these vivid memories of that. But John Kennedy was really the one who was interested in the grounds.
Hmm.
And so he was sort of lawn obsessed, which I know is kind of, you know, a cliche, but he was. And he came back from this diplomatic tour of Europe where he had seen places like Versailles and Buckingham Palace. And he cuts back and he says, you know, this is, looks a little shabby here. So they were friends with Rachel Lambert Mellon, Bunny Mellon, family friends, and she was really a fabulous horticulturist. And so he asked her to help to design a space for him that could be both garden and almost theater.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so the Rose Garden, it has, you know, the design, you know, criteria for it would be like, I have to be able to seat 1,000 people. And I need a place where I can have a podium where I can be seen above the news cameras, but the honorees are even higher than I am.
Right.
So he had a lot of ideas of kind of symbolism. And then he wanted something traditional. So, you know, if you think about colonial revival and kind of the interest that Jackie had in antiques for the inside of the White House, JFK kind of wanted the same thing for the exterior.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what she designs for them. She said that she got a real idea for the anchors from walking along in front of the Frick on Fifth Avenue, the Frick Museum.
Right.
And there are beautiful magnolias out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so she got some big magnolias from other federal property in Washington. She had them dug up and put into the Rose Garden. And then she used the crab apples and a kind of a little geometric pattern, lots of tulips, not that many roses, surprisingly. That was one of the surprises along the way. I mean, there are some roses, but not as many as you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
So it really worked out.
So they created, so this is what is known as the Kennedy Rose Garden. Is that right, Marta?
Yes, and it's still there.
Right.
But it has been replaced once completely.
Oh.
So, you know, like 40 years in, the crab apples had gotten so big that they had to basically plant the roses as annuals because there was so much shade.
Right.
Wow.
So, well, you know, things get overgrown. So if you're going to have this little manicured setup, you kind of have to trade them out. So that did happen at one point along the way.
And then, this is kind of where I'm born, right? Late 60s, early 70s. And what I remember, because I actually lived in Washington, D.C. as a kid, so this is very, very close to my heart because we spent a lot of time walking around. And I also remember the whole Keep America Beautiful campaign. And you have an amazing poster in the book, in the spirit of Ogden Nash. I think that I shall never see a billboard as lovely as a tree. Indeed, unless the billboard falls, I shall never see a tree at all. So now there's this whole, so at Kennedy is all this like opulence and elegance, and now there's this push for environmentalism and beautification, recreation, pollution, and mental health is what you say in the book.
Yes, and that really comes from Lady Bird Johnson.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, just as Michelle Obama has had the Let's Move campaign, the mm-hmm. vegetable garden has been a part of that. Mm-hmm. Lady Bird Johnson got behind Keep America Beautiful, the Highway Act, which, you know, is a reason why we don't have billboards on every single interstate
right.
in the country, although I don't know what happened to Route 78 in New Jersey, but that's yeah. a whole nother story.
Yeah.
And Lady Bird clearly understood that, you know, the word beautification was not the best. Like, it was sort of, people would say, well, beautification, you know, and kind of minimize it. But she understood that it had to do with environmentalism and that that was really an important thing
right.
for the country.
Right.
You know, because, like, Lake Erie was on fire. You know, we kind of don't remember that sometimes. But things were really awful. There was, like, Love Canal. And, you
right.
know.
Yeah. I remember that. Right.
Yeah. And I don't think she gets the credit that she deserves, Lady Bird. I think she was, like,
no.
really ahead of the curve in terms of native plants.
Right.
And
right.
thinking about places, you know, like.
And places of plants and yeah. appropriate plant historicity.
Yeah, I think
and,
she yeah. was, like, 40 years ahead of the curve.
Right.
You know.
And then Nixon's.
Yeah, and I will say that the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower mm-hmm. Organization has done a lot and has the best kind of general wildflower resource online available. So mm-hmm. that's been really great.
And Nixon's,
that's a nice legacy.
Nixon's daughter got married in the Rose Garden. That was like the first kind of public event in the Rose Garden. Is that right?
And televised, right?
Yeah.
Really big deal to have this televised event. Again, it was almost like a royal wedding.
Yeah.
So, very lavish, lots of flowers. And so the Rose Garden has been the setting for so many things, right?
Right?
We almost don't think about it because it's just kind of part of what we are.
Right.
It's like the White House itself, regardless of what cable news station you watch, if it's about the presidency, the North Portico is behind the newscaster.
Yes,
yeah,
I mean, yes.
Right.
That's the landscape we see with those magnificent trees that have been planted essentially since John Quincy Adams, you know, kind of straightforward.
Yeah.
So.
And President Carter and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, you know, in their meeting in the Rose Garden, like that, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, it's very poignant. I mean, it really affected me sort of going through and kind of reliving the ones I remembered.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of connecting to what we were all doing. I mean, mm-hmm. I was watching Thalassa Crusoe on TV.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of over-the-top TV gardening personality.
Yeah.
I only wish they'd put them back on again. So
yeah,
here's
that
a
would
plug
be
for WGBH to, like, dust off their archive.
They should.
WGBH is so cutting edge.
I know.
I mean, that nerdy kind of, you know, academic sort of way.
Well, they do. Well,
they're awesome.
I know they
yeah.
are. I mean, I was watching a gardening show at the time, but it was called The Magic Garden.
Yeah.
It really is
New York.
That's
that.
Now that's New York. There's two hippies
yeah.
playing guitar, a squirrel that had like a Bronx accent. That was my gardening show.
Okay, but we have to also talk about the Reagans, right? And the rose,
yes.
which they kind of deem as the national emblem of the United States.
And did they make it the official flower?
Yes, and Jackson and Perkins named the two roses, the Nancy Reagan and the Ronald Reagan rose. And that's, you know, he was the great communicator, right? And here he is using horticulture as a bridge.
That's interesting.
Yes. So if you want a presidential garden, the best flower to grow would be the rose, because they tend to have roses named after them. I forgot to check to see whether there have been Michelle and Barack Obama roses, but I wouldn't be at all surprised. So Reagan, again, I wouldn't have passed a quiz on the fact that the rose is the national floral emblem of the United States of America.
Right.
I know there's like the Tournament of Roses parade, and we have the All America Rose selections and things like that. But it has been done. There are native roses, so we have to say yes. We have our own wild roses.
Mm-hmm.
But they have been grown. Again, since that first order from James Madison, he did have roses. And so I think they have been grown consistently on the White House grounds since the beginning. So, that does make sense. There's been a rose garden for a long time. So at least back as far as the Wilsons, there has been something called a rose garden on the grounds. So, okay.
Yeah.
We have roses. And I did find that great picture of Ronald Reagan before he was president, when he was the chairman of the Tournament of Roses parade.
Right. I found that very interesting.
I think that's a very appropriate parade for him.
Yeah.
For him to be chairman.
So I will say, in the Rose Garden, if there are roses planted that are named after other presidents, they tend to take those out between administrations.
Really?
Oh, that's funny. That's very funny.
I guess it's like the children's play equipment, right? That doesn't stay either.
Yeah.
Even if there's another family, it is a private house for the term of the office. So they will take it out and put in new play equipment
for the
children.
And they want to kind of make it their own, right? I mean, each president has added. Who added a tennis court? Was it Kennedy? No.
No. Teddy Roosevelt added the tennis court.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it also got moved around.
Right.
I have never seen the tennis court, the basketball court, or the swimming pool. You have to be personal friends of the president or a diplomat, so I did not rate that. But I did get to see the Obama vegetable garden and the beehives close up and the pollinator garden, which I did not know was there
until
I actually had this solo tour of the grounds. So right next to the vegetable garden, there is a fairly substantial bed of local pollinator plants, which I think is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you one. We were just talking about Lady Bird Johnson. Did Barbara Bush, because when I was reading about the Bush administration, and this is GW, GW did the chestnut and the elm plantings, right? As kind of an ode to those great American trees.
The senior Bush, George H.W. Bush, they did replant things like the elm that John Quincy Adams had planted, so in the very early part of the 19th century, finally had to be taken down. It had a second lightning strike, and so they had to remove it. But they had, the head gardener then, Irv Williams, had grafted a piece of the original elm onto new rootstock. So they were able to replant, some of part of this tree. So Barbara Bush was there at the time, and so she did replant that. President Bush, with Queen Elizabeth, planted lindens against the old lindens that had been planted to commemorate her parents' coronation, had to be taken out, and so they replanted some lindens. So there is this long, kind of poignant tradition of commemorative tree planting, and the trees are beautiful. I mean, of all of the parts of the White House grounds, that is what I found most impressive. In addition to the view, which is this, long view that was specified by Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. To the Washington Monument, the trees are just breathtaking. They are fabulous.
And can people, if they get tickets to get like a White House tour, the grounds are they included at all, or are they pretty much off limits?
No, there are two open weekends generally every year. You can get tickets. Again, I think your congressman's probably the best way, because they tend not to announce it in advance.
Right.
I guess for security. I'm not sure why.
Yeah.
And So we just drove down the day of when we found out it was going to happen. And you wait in line, but it's nicely managed. And you don't get to see everything because it is a mob scene. So they cordon off a lot of things.
Right.
But it is a nice way to walk through the grounds. And people were having just a lovely time. That and the Easter egg roll. So I think you need a child, though. You have to either have or borrow a child.
So yep. let me. Unfortunately, our time is up, Marta. But you have this amazing quote at the end of your book, and I'd like to read it. And you talk about Dickens and his kind of idea of Washington, and you say it was a new garden in a new city, a youth that had not reached maturity. That is no longer true. Of the city of Washington, Charles Dickens wrote, it is sometimes called the city of magnificent distances, but it might, with greater propriety, be termed the city of magnificent intentions. Perhaps magnificent intentions are the best way to describe the White House gardens then and now. Perhaps magnificent intentions can describe American gardening at large. Across the 50 states, gardeners create, preserve, and restore. Gardens beautify, nourish, and memorialize. Long may they wave. Which I love.
Oh, that's great.
That paragraph summed up everything about the book. But the book is so charming in all the detail and the
we've just barely
history.
Touched yeah. it. We didn't even get into, you have a whole section, Marta, on the first gardeners. And so we talked about the presidents and the first ladies and all the designers and the influencers. But the people that were actually doing the work, you give them a lot of space in the book, too.
Yeah.
And I think people should read about these individuals as well.
I fell in love with them. They were my obsession. There was a point where I had to move all that material because it was starting to be a book about these people.
Yeah, right. So, all right, before we leave, Marta, because you have a fascinating line of work. What's next for you as both a historian and a gardener?
Are you allowed to say?
So, I am currently working on a book about Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Oh my God!
You have just rocked
my
world.
Hero.
That's so fun.
I know. Yeah. I can't tell
so
you.
I have moved from Washington, D.C. Basically, my entire focus has been the Midwest. With the exception of Malone, New York, which is not close to anything, P.S. For those of you who don't know, Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote a series of books called The Little House Book.
Oh, my God.
Of which Little House on the Prairie is the most famous because of the TV show.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But she is much beloved, and she wrote a lot about plants and landscape.
Really?
And I am arguing that you can read her as a nature writer and also a writer about agricultural history in the country.
That's so
and
interesting.
So, you know, it's been a very interesting process to research this. There are so many people who know so much about this woman that it's a little daunting.
It's cultish.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, but I figured, oh, well, you know, I took on the president. I guess I could do Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Oh, Marta, what a fun project. I can't wait. Do you have a timeline for this?
Yes, it should be out, if all of the fates cooperate, by Christmas 2017.
Okay.
So, well, fingers crossed.
We will be following you.
And
we will
have you back on.
We love her. I can't tell you how many little house books I stole from the library.
Oh, I remember reading them. I remember reading them all.
I was obsessed.
Me too.
I wanted to be her.
Oh, yeah. Everybody did. The little grass hut. All right. Marta, thank you for joining us. And thank you for writing such an amazing, fun book. And such chock full of histories and details and great information. Thank you for all of your work.
Thank you, Alice and Carmen. I love We Dig Plants.
Thank you.
So, folks, buy the book.
Buy the book.
You can get it on Amazon, of course. You can get it from Timber Press.
It's a great read.
It's a good summer read. It's a great, you know, you want to take a break from the politics.
Uh-huh.
Read this book. It's so much better.
You'll have faith again.
And you can follow us. You can follow us on all kinds of social media. Instagram, we're at Groundworks Gardens NYC. On Twitter, at We Dig Plants. And, of course, on Facebook. Happy gardening. See you in the garden.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.